Okay, so I'm gonna try to respond to some of the things that I've heard so far these past 2 weeks with an assortment of relevant simulations that we've done at NYU. And this is work done with Paul Duffel, who's now at Berkeley, Hendrik Wennerten at Bath, George Ryan, who's my current student at NYU, and Jonathan Zrake, who's a postdoc at Stanford. So let's see, so I have a couple of things I wanna say. The first is, I guess, what would be called a dirty fireball. So the basic idea is that when two neutron stars merge, there's a large shear layer between them, of course, and that generates a shear instability, which amplifies magnetic field to equipartition with the kinetic energy density of turbulence that is in this layer. And I'm going to show that that can be up to 10 to the 51 ergs of magnetic energy right at this interface, which in principle, so we haven't calculated light curves yet, I'm sorry, but it should, it's magnetic material, it should generate synchrotron emission, and that should be blue, Nancy. So I don't know exactly yet, but I just want to emphasize this. The other is GRB afterglow light curves. Some of the curves we saw, I guess, yesterday from the were, you know, that's, I think, that very optimistic that the densities would that be that high. So we've actually generated a bunch of light curves that you can download from the internet, and it's called the Afterglow Library. And you'll see that if you go to maybe a more realistic circumburst medium outside of a galaxy, I mean, maybe there's some small kicks and they're stuck in a dense region, but sometimes, if you're lucky. But in general, they're quite a bit fainter. So I'm going to mention, because of that, you know, maybe some will be like this, but maybe they're all like that. So I'm going to mention some other ways you can get jet light from, and in this case, you require a jet. So this doesn't require jet formation after the merger. This will. So, but if you have a relativistic jet propagating into a circumburst medium, it's going to generate synchrotron emission, just like other forms of GRBs, and that should be bright emission if you have enough energy. But, and that's a standard thing, so I'll just show you a little bit of that. What I want to emphasize in this talk is something that's new, which is an emission component that's essentially an internal shock. So it's ejecta hitting ejecta, and it doesn't require a surrounding medium to generate light from kinetic energy. And I think, and so this is something that I think I'm going to work on now based on this meeting, because I think it's really important. This is beamed, so it'll be something that might be hard to see, whatever, the numbers might go down, but I think it may be less beamed than the prompt emission of a short GRB if that's being made. But I'll talk about this, and it happens even if a short GRB doesn't happen. Okay, so those are the things I want to tell you about. It could. It requires jet formation. So for a low-mass black hole, if you get a disk and jet formation, then yes, this could happen. So it's for both. Let me just remind everyone, this was already mentioned by talks by Francois Fergoccoa and Louis Lehner earlier in the meeting, but it was first pointed out by Price and Roswag in 2006 with SPH simulations that the contact surface between the neutron stars just before they merge has a really strong shear. Okay, and that's obvious. You have two things merging, there's going to be a shear layer. And this has been followed up even recently by the Shibata's group, I think, and they also see the same thing, and they're getting, this is really high resolution, extremely expensive simulation, but it's still, I think, very hard to have converged numerical results and that are global. So what I'm going to show you is some local simulations where we take a tiny little patch and we look at how much magnetic energy is generated, assuming that there's this shear flow on large scales. So it's a local simulation, and then we're going to couple that to a global simulation as a subgrid model and calculate the amount of magnetic energy produced at neutron star mergers. Okay, so it's just, I think this is really beautiful. So this is somewhere near Aspen, probably. There's air flowing over the mountain, and so there's a shear flow here, fast air, slow air, and the clouds act as tracers and show you this kind of wave formation, just like when you generate waves from wind over the ocean. So you get this kind of thing. And then what happens is these, you know, you have shear everywhere, and on all scales, you have shear. So you're generating from bulk kinetic energy, you're generating small scale motion, which cascades to smaller and smaller scales and generates turbulence, a turbulent cascade. And why is that interesting? It's interesting because no matter how small a magnetic field is, so here's a piece of a field line, it's going to be folded by the turbulence, and the density of field lines is going to increase. So just turbulence is going to, there's going to be some tension in these field lines, so they'll back react on the flow. But the basic idea is that the kinetic energy of turbulence can grow magnetic field. Okay, and so this is a fairly old slide, but I want to show it to you because it's a nice thing. We're interested in this in emerging neutron stars or neutron star black holes, if they're sheer. But it's also relevant for outflows, which in reality are probably clumpy and turbulent themselves, and also in jets where there's shear flow. So this is a very ubiquitous problem and very important to understand how shear flows generate magnetic fields. So we set up, I'll just show you a movie that some of you have seen before, but it's a relativistic fluid with a trans-relativistic shear, and let's just see what happens. And what we do, just for numerical convenience, is we have a periodic box. So there's the stuff in the middle is going out, and the stuff on top and the bottom are going in. We rotated it. And what you see is a typical thing. You get these cat eyes that form, and then you get turbulence that forms at the interface. And this is just rotating so you can see it. But then after this keeps on going for a while, this turbulence starts to fill the volume. So it starts off in a thin layer, but there's all these kind of interesting waves traveling around. But very quickly, you can see that the magnetic field goes from very weak to starting to be in equipartition. So this low number, red, means that the magnetic field is strong. So if you know the kinetic energy density of turbulent fluid, then from here we can show that at the end, at saturation, the magnetic energy density reaches 60% of the kinetic turbulent energy density. So it's a huge amount of magnetic field. I'm going to show you in a second. So this is an older one. I'm going to show you a more careful thing. So this is more recent. Is Jonathan Drake, my student, did this for his thesis, and he did extremely high resolution simulations of relativistic MHD turbulence and also hydro turbulence. And you see there's some very beautiful structures, but all these small scales are winding up field. And I'll show you the spectrum in just a second. Okay, so this is scale free. But what we're envisioning is a patch that's a few meters cubed. So it's embedded in a shear flow that's of kilometer scale. And we're zooming in on a little piece of it. Okay. And so so what Jonathan found is that this is the magnetic field and is a function of resolution. So it was hard for him to converge. But when we got up to resolutions of 1024 cubed and higher, the magnetic field saturates here at 4.5 times 10 to the 16 Gauss. So really strong field growing from nothing. There's a plot here. We started with different seed fields, arbitrarily low. It doesn't matter. It very quickly winds up, and then that winds up. And so there's a very fast phase, which grows. You can see this magnetic energy. It grows really quickly at first. And then there's a different stage where it comes to a saturation and then through this, some process. And this shows the magnetic and turbulent energies. The point is, very strong fields if you have enough resolution to resolve the turbulent cascade. So we should expect this. Large regions, no matter what. And this doesn't require anything else, just two fluids that shear past each other under neutron star conditions, and this is the fields that we should expect. And so this is a Jonathan thing. It's just spinning so you can see everything. So it's driven on large scales, and once again, the red is showing magnetic field. So just in one large eddy turnover time, the magnetic field is almost in equipartition with the kinetic energy, but then over 4 to 8 crossing times of the box, the field saturates. So there's a slow growth period, but then it saturates. And so what we found here is that the magnetic energy density is 0.6, the total energy density of the kinetic energy. Yeah, we're going to show that. Yeah.
That's really surprising.
Yeah, I'll show it. So here is the spectrum, and it's a kind of a movie. And so the magnetic energy is tiny here. It's orders of magnitude below the kinetic energy. And what you're going to see is the, in terms of large eddy turnover size, so this is the scale of the whole box, you're going to see the growth of both magnetic and... Yeah, and blue is magnetic, yeah. And so I should probably stop it, but let's go through it once first. Okay, so you both grow, and then you get this, this is Kazantsev's k to the 3/2. This has been, so on small scales, it's growing, and then it goes into super equipartition and then climbs to larger and larger scales. And you can see here the magnetic energy, the total energy in the box is now growing slowly after a quick phase, and it's coming up to almost equipartition. And then at some stage, the magnetic energy reaches the scale of the whole box, and that's what you saw. So it's actually in super equipartition on small scales. There's more net magnetic energy than kinetic energy. But if you integrate over the whole box, there's a lot of volume here, then it's 60%.
So basically, it looks like it's becoming flat, right? There's nothing left of the Magora. So there's yeah.
Right, it's also unwinding. So on these scales, the field is back reacting and unwinding it, and then it kind of climbs up. But yeah, so it's possible. So you can see it's still evolving. These are extremely expensive. So if we could go to 20 turnover times, this may change. But at this, but yeah, the point, what we were really, really looking for here is the converged total magnetic energy. So yeah, this. Yeah, so there should, on this scale, there should be many, so tens. Yeah, so, right. Okay, so then we used that model to do a full, this is a numerical relativity with Bruno Giacomazzo, GRMHD. And then this model for the magnetic energy growth, the local growth, depends on the curl of the velocity field. It's basically the component of the velocity field that's shearing. And what we found is that if you take this curl and use the model that we derived from the local simulations, we found growth of magnetic energy. So it's here, and it's here at this interface. And so this is very strong magnetic field. It's a tiny fraction of the total energy of the system, but this total energy in the magnetic field is 10 to the 51 ergs. So it's a huge amount of energy, maybe 0.1% of the total energy, but still, that's a like a short GRB on its own with no disk, just from shear flow. It can be arbitrarily small. So we started with extremely weak fields, like 10 to the 8 Gauss, but it didn't matter. There's a very fast, rapid growth that brings it up high, and then there's a transient where it kind of grows slow, more slowly, and then it reaches saturation. These are, yeah, okay.
Is so, thermal energy any different than in high growth? So if you're less, how much hot stuff is there around?
Yeah, so that's true. Since the energy density is comparable to the kinetic energy density, I think it's still dominated by thermal energy in this piece of it. But yeah, it would be a small perturbation.
So how much is the field energy, is the thermal energy going up from magnetic dissipation?
Yeah, yeah.
On small scales?
Yeah, yeah. So it goes up a little bit. And that was actually the whole challenge to do the simulation. We have a cooling term to remove that energy. Otherwise, it becomes really hot and the turbulence changes and becomes some. Changes, it becomes very subsonic. So we do remove the energy. But in principle,
in the local one,
yeah. So the model has cooling. But in principle, that should really be happening. There should be some sort of physical reconnection that'll, and this is buoyant magnetic field. It'll probably rise to the surface and explode in some way. So that's like maybe a magnetic fireball or magnetic dirty fireball, something like that.
So when
yeah.
You have these results, you set four neutron stars here. Mm-hmm. How specific are what your simulations, how specific are their results to neutron star conditions? Is there anything special about a neutron star, or if I have any kind of sure
note? I think this is generic. We did use appropriate equation of state for neutron star and temperatures and so on, but I don't think that mattered particularly. It was, yeah, so, yeah. It's, yeah, it's very high. It's like a magnetar strength field. Yeah. And I don't see any way to avoid that. It's disordered, yeah. So that would be beautiful if it somehow created a dynamo and generated. So that would be wonderful. We can't say anything about that. So this is tangled field. We don't increase the flux. We just increase the field strength. But nonetheless, that has a pressure associated with it, and it's buoyant compared to neutron star fluid. So it should rise and explode. So here's just to show previously, people were getting tiny magnetic field growth. So if they started a few times 10 to the 11, they get up to 2 times 10 to the 12. But with this model, we find a few times 10 to the 16. And then this is converged as a function of resolution. So you can see at first it doesn't grow, but here it's converged. So we can converge with the subgrid model. Without it, I don't think it's possible yet, maybe in 10 or 20 years at extremely high resolution. In that case, we know we don't have the cooling. We just have the model based on the cooling. But in that case, there's a limited time scale, right? It's just the time. So there isn't as much. So, yeah. So in principle, since our model is based on a cooling, there is implicitly a cooling in there. Okay. So anyway, I guess this is what's termed a dirty fireball, but it is something that you have baryons and you have very strong magnetic field that should expand away no matter what. And so this should make some sort of thing, like a magnetic fireball, and it has energy at this scale. So this is a predictor. This kind of thing should be seen. And it's completely independent of any short GRB formation that may happen later. So this is before any black hole or disk forms. So calculating what this looks like is basically a problem that's doable, I think. You start with some dirty magnetic outflow, and you calculate synchrotron emission, and synchrotron emission is blue. It's not certain. And that's why it requires some work to find out how much escapes. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So, right, right. So that's the kind of thing that we don't know yet. So if we can. Oh, at this stage, it's too much because it's still in this kind of shear layer. Where we're. Oh, it's not a huge amount, but it's enough to baryon load it a lot. I don't know that number exactly, but I'd estimate that it's probably a few hundredths of a solar mass. But that needs to be checked. So it may not be ultra relativistic, but nonetheless, it should be synchrotron emitting. Okay, so the next step, this is now I'm going to change topics. So recently, I've been working for a long time on ultra-relativistic jets. So here, we assume that the engine has formed. There's a short GRB now. It's generated an ultra-relativistic outflow. And that's driven a shock wave into the interstellar medium. And I'm very happy to report that we're now able to do really high Lorentz factors just by going into a kind of co-moving, a boosted frame. And it's really nice because a very narrow jet then opens up. But then, so we do these simulations of the jets that are propagating from an engine deep down inside. And from this, we can calculate, again, the synchrotron emission. So we know the energy density in the fluid. We know its velocity. And so the really cool thing we've been able to do is calculate light curves, not just along the symmetry axis, but for viewers at all angles. Because what we do is we save the time history of the simulation. And from it, we sum up the total synchrotron emissivity with the Doppler boost and so on for an observer at a fixed angle, and we calculate light curves. And those are also available if you're interested. So the new thing here is, I think, accurate, fully resolved dynamics, but just to make contact with previous models, we use the standard synchrotron parameters. I have another thing where actually I think you can generate magnetic field from Rayleigh Taylor instabilities, but I'm not going to talk about that. I can tell you about that later if you're interested. But here we use an epsilon B. So basically, we just assume, actually, we just assume some fraction of the energy density of the fluid is magnetic. But you can just solve from the previous thing, which was for very different conditions, but nonetheless, if there's any kind of fluid instabilities due to shaking and clumpiness or whatever, you can see again that that epsilon b is really pretty natural. And in fact, we've calculated light curves not using an epsilon b, but just using the turbulent energy density in the fluid that comes from Rayleigh-Taylor instability. I'll get to that in a second. Okay, so anyway, very accurate hydro simulations of ultra-relativistic jets generated from the short GRB. And then what we do is we solve the transfer equations with a synchrotron source term. And so we can do this, we can cut slices at any, so we can calculate it at any thing. And we do, right now we do optically thin, but we also have synchrotron self-absorption. So we can calculate low frequency radio light curves as well. Okay. So, and these are some that you've seen before, but it gives you a sense of what we have. This goes from gigahertz all the way up to the X-ray. And these are all the light curves you'd see if you were on axis. This is near the edge of the jet. But these are the orphan light curves that you'd see if you were off axis. And this is at the equator. So you'd see something, but it'd be quite faint. And that depends on the dense circumburst density. So I can just show you.
How different are these results from just the simple analytic that can be
used? There is some agreement, but the most important is that the jet break is smoother. So the analytic ones have a sharp jet break. So that's the most important thing. So just to show you, here's the website. It's called Afterglow Library. And for short GRBs, we called them low-energy GRBs. So it's this one here. And you can select an energy, a circumburst density, the opening angle of the jet, but also the viewing angle. And if you just click on this, it'll give you a plot. And then you can also download the data if you want to make a plot. So you're welcome to use this if you'd like. And then the other thing I'd say is that, you know, if you go down to 10 to the minus 5, which might be the density you'd expect outside of a galaxy, they become faint very quickly. So this is in Milojanski's.
But you said this is so far still all optically
thin. Right. So for 75 megahertz, that's not right. But we do have it. We do have synchrotron self-absorption now. So this is from. It is on the web. Yeah, it is. Yeah. So this is, if you look here, it's on. Actually, it's on my website and it hasn't been uploaded yet, but it will be. But anyway, for all these frequencies, higher frequencies, it's not important. So it's optically thin to synchrotron, but at 75 megahertz, it's not.
Andrew,
yeah. I have not, and that's why I put them on the website, because I'm not good at that kind of thing. So hopefully someone will. Or maybe I will, yeah. Okay, so now I'm going to talk about newer stuff. And this is, Paul Duffel did some really nice simulations with Elliot. And the basic idea was there's an ejecta cloud from a neutron star merger. And the kind of cool thing is, since it's a lot of angular momentum in the system, the cloud is flattened. And because of that, even a hydrodynamical jet can be focused, which is really interesting. So it could be kind of some kind of, you don't need an engine to make a very narrow jet, even if you have some sort of outflow that's broader, it can be focused into a relativistic collimated jet, which is cool. So the thing that I've been thinking about, and the reason I'm showing you this, is the exact same thing happens in a star. And there's a new emission component that I want to talk about. And what that is the little bit of material at the surface of the ejecta cloud or a star, it doesn't really matter, where the jet accelerates at, you know, I think I have a picture that, this is also an older movie that some of you have seen, but I think, I'm not sure if I have it here. So let me just say, the point is, when a jet burrows its way through a cloud, when it breaks, it's most of the mass in front of it is shocked and it forms a cocoon. And you can kind of see it here in this red. It's kind of a little bit hard to see. But when the jet breaks out of the surface of whatever is confining it, it starts to accelerate. And the material, that the last little bit of material, is accelerated to relativistic speed. And it's no longer capable of moving sideways to get out of the way. So what you always have is a little cap of material in front of a relativistic jet. And so this should happen in short GRBs that happen in ejecta clouds. And the key thing that's interesting about that is we can calculate what happens when, you know, initially the jet just escapes and it travels along. They're both moving at the speed of light almost, but the cap is moving slightly slower, and the jet will eventually collide with it, so with itself, basically, ejecta colliding with ejecta, and that makes a very bright signature that doesn't require dense circumburst matter. And so what the really important technical thing that we've been able to do recently is have numerical hydrodynamics and MHD codes that are capable of expanding with an outflow as it's generated near central engine at the size of a compact object, a few kilometers, all the way till it breaks out of the surface of an ejecta cloud or the surface of a star, forms prompt emission, and then afterglow. So all of this in one simulation. So it's really nice. So it doesn't require multiple steps. And what's really good about that is this connects observables with engines for the first time. And so this is a code that Paul Duffel wrote when he was a student. And it was based initially on a Voronoi tessellation, which you may have heard of for cosmology. And I think it's kind of cool just to show because it's pretty. But the basic idea is, as you can imagine, if you have a flow like a jet that's moving, you want the mesh to move with the flow so you don't have noise generated or diffusion generated that's not needed. And so you can get things like really nice, this is Kelvin-Helmholtz again, like you saw earlier, but at very low resolution, it's very, very efficient and nice. And this is kind of cool. This is a fish. I really love this. That is a Voronoi tessellation for its scales. For a few more minutes. Yeah, I'm almost done. But here's the thing that's even more important than the Voronoi tessellation. It turns out that's maybe overly fancy because it generates some numerical noise. But if instead you force the cells to just move radially, that they can shear past each other, then you have all the benefit you really want. So you have some sort of explosion, and it ejects, flings off this tiny flicker of material relativistically, but the mesh moves with it, so it follows it. So it's really good. It's Lagrangian, essentially, as Lagrangian as it needs to be, to be able to do these really hard problems where small amounts of material are flung away and generate a lot of light. So that's a really new thing. And so what we've applied it to is, you know, the earlier stuff I showed you for afterglows, we started with the Blanford-McKee solution, which used to very nicely reproduce these jet breaks, two power laws. That was really fun. That was before Swift, but Swift made life more complicated. And instead, you see at early times some sort of rapidly decaying thing and some sort of plateau-like feature. And so we're trying to understand that, and I think we understand that very well, and this is what I'm claiming might be an electromagnetic signature, even if there's no ISM interaction. And the basic idea is, okay, this is the movie I wanted to show you earlier, that as the jet burrows through a star, it's pushing most of the stuff into a turbulent cocoon. This is, but when it breaks out, and this is 2D, so it's overestimated, but even in 3D, there's a little bit of material ahead of the jet. So this is gamma 100. And this is slower material, but when that accelerates as it breaks out of the star, it has to stay ahead of the jet. And then what Paul Duffel was able to do is follow this all the way with this relativistic Lagrangian code. So the mesh is expanding, and this jet is propagating, And what he finds is that as the jet breaks out, you almost can't see it, but there's a little cap of material in front of it. And then he cuts out the center of the star and allows it to expand all the way into the afterglow. So this is out of sonic communication. It doesn't matter anymore. But now you can see the jet forming. And eventually, the jet catches up with the cap ahead of it. And that happens at after the prompt emission has already happened, if there's prompt emission. And that's really tailored and stable here. But here's the important takeaway message from all of this, is that you have all these scales in one simulation. But here it is, okay? So what happened is initially the jet accelerated to Lorentz factor 100, but then it coasted for a while, but then it collided with the slower material in front of it. And what we're claiming is that's a very bright thing that happens before the Blanford-McKee phase, where it's an external shock. So this is a big internal collision, which decelerates the jet from Lorentz factor 100 down to of order 50. So it really decelerates, and we can calculate a light curve. So essentially, the jet collides with its cap. There's a reverse shock traveling through the jet, and that thing radiates synchrotron emission. And this is what it looks like. So what we have is this collision generates a very rapidly declining, very bright thing, almost as bright as the prompt emission initially, very rapidly decaying. And then it coasts for a while, and that makes a plateau. And that does require an ISM. So that's a slower jet, which takes longer to decelerate because it's been decelerated by colliding with itself. And then you get Blanford-McKee. So what I'm saying is that, is that this component should happen in any kind of relativistic outflow from a short burst. It's a few hundred seconds long. It should be visible in the optical as well. And it doesn't require either a short GRB to have it happened earlier, and it doesn't require ISM. So this is what we call the top heavy jet. It's a big internal collision. And I think this is generic and should be happen in all situations where a jet breaks out of an ejecta cloud or a star. OK, thanks. It could be. So it's related to it. So the standard picture with prompt emission, and this is just a cartoon, is that before these things are coasting together, that there's some dissipation here. That's not really well understood. It's thought that maybe some variability in the engine means that in reality there's a bunch of internal shocks in here that are or magnetic dissipation are causing the prompt emission. But that what I'm saying is, even if that happens or not, doesn't matter. It's still got to collide with itself later. So, and it's a longer lived. The idea with short GRBs, by design, is that this dissipation happens on timescales of less than a second, whereas this collision is hundreds of seconds.
So, in this particular
simulation, was from the breakout from the star? Or? Yeah, but yes, it was. But that's why I showed you the breakout from the ejecta cloud. So we're planning to join these two together. So that's what this meeting has inspired me to do. I think so, but I'm not certain. Because I think it's the very last bit. And so I think in both cases, there's some sort of gradient at the surface of the cloud or the star. So it's always going to accelerate there. And so I think, so maybe the slope of the surface of the star versus the cloud. But we're going to find out. So I don't know, but I suspect it's similar. Yeah, so this is the same opening angle of the jet. So if it's, it's probably in short GRBs, it might be fairly wide unless it's collimated like we saw earlier. But the key is, so it might be wider because the Lorentz factor is lower than the prompt emission. But that's not a robust thing. So it might be slightly wider, but I can't say for sure. It'd be nice if it was broadly beamed, but I think this component has the same issue as the prompt emission in the sense that it is beamed, but it has an advantage in that it's longer lived, so maybe that's helpful.
that it has a velocity greater than escape velocity.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
That's obvious to me.
Oh,
the numbers are not.
You're talking about the metrics here.
Yeah.
Oh, that, okay, yeah. All right. That's not obvious. And that's why I said that's what we need to work on. But I'm just saying that, you know, there's strong field and it's buoyant, so it could rise up. You're right, it may still be bound. I don't know. But even if it is, it's still plasma with a strong magnetic field. We should calculate what it looks like. So.
Well, I think it's an electron positive from plasma. It's clear to me how many, whether you're actually ripping off the surface and you have enough energy to get it on the well and so on.
Yeah, yeah. We don't know. So that's the thing we have to do.
In which case, you get a very short flash rather than a long-lived, you know, that stuff that interacts with ISM and the whole business.
Right, yeah. So, yeah. Yeah.
10 to 51 Earth, 100 to the solar mass before the surface of the neutron star is
producing. It may not. Right. So again, the 100 solar mass is just an estimate, so that's the thing that has to be calculated. But it's a very clear path, which is to use the subgrid model in a high resolution simulation, and then we'll know. So I'm just saying this is interesting and possibly of interest, but we don't know yet what the light curve is, but I think it's calculable.
Well, the other thing we should do is that train one that goes from South New York to La Columbia?
Yes.
Yeah, maybe talk to Brian Metzger.
Right. Oh, I thought you were going to repeat an earlier thing. Okay. Yes, we do talk to him sometimes.
I have some basic issues that are useful.
Right, yes. Yeah, yeah.
So I'm just wondering about stretching neutron stars. Is it very different than neutron stars? So are the results applicable to light more?
I think it is. Yeah.
I think their first calculation actually was what more. I mean, there was at least somebody in the memory.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it could be. I think it's a really interesting thing to look for, I think. There you also have reactive flow because it can burn, so it might swamp this, but I'm not sure. So it should happen. It's just if you get a lot of burning really quickly, it might overwhelm the magnetic part. But maybe this happens first. And so, yeah. So this could be a precursor to something else. Yeah, yeah. It would be some shorter and probably synchrotron dominated thing.
Well, there's a long-standing it's a mystery that most people ignore, but which is as white dwarfs. I'm not of any, you know, I'm just of a movie at this point. Mm-hmm. The accumulate matter, it's curious. The white dwarf, in most cases that I know, there's no indication the white dwarf is spinning rapidly, mm-hmm. except when the matter is accumulating. We know exactly what speed it is going to accumulate because I know the Keplerian field for that. And I always wondered whether this somehow these magnetic fields come in and in some weird way that angular momentum is never steadily accumulated in the white hole. It's actually worth looking into. There's a lot of data here, no thinking.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think what we did is almost identical. It's a different equation of state, different, but so yeah, that's, yeah.